Trish and Rob McGregor welcome you to a place where all kinds of phenomena flourish. Here we meet authors, researchers, and investigators of the mysterious, the strange, and of the inexplicable anomalies that surround us. Step out of the everyday world and take a journey into the mystical underground.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to the Mystical Underground. Thank you for joining us. This is Trish McGregor and
Rob McGregor.
And our producer and tech magician, John Posey. You can go to themysticalunderground.com where we make regular blog posts and you can find out about our books. Among them are Phenomena Harnessing Your Psychic Abilities, The Secret of Spirit Communication, Sensing the Future, and Aliens in the Backyard. Our newest book is called Mind-Blowing Synchronicities, The Latest Science Stories and Research. Trisha's newest novel is Silent Thunder, which is to be published in January of 2026. And Rob's most recent novel is called Tulpas, a story of mysterious beings created through deep meditation. If you're watching us on YouTube, we would appreciate it if you'd take a moment to click the like, subscribe, and notification buttons so you never miss an episode. If you prefer to listen to the show, it's available wherever you listen to podcasts. Please subscribe there.
Okay, our guest today is Arthur Bruce Lewis, who is the founder and president of the Eros Institute, a nonprofit dedicated to restoring the sacred into modern life. Formerly chair of the Department of Religious Studies at Michigan State University, he is the author of numerous acclaimed books, including Sacred Earth and The Secret History of Western Sexual Mysticism. His latest book is Alchemical Light Work, A Guide to Creating Cultures of Light and Spiritual Awakening. In it, Arthur blends ancient alchemy with the modern practice of light work to offer a bold roadmap to personal and cultural awakening. Welcome, Arthur.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So your book is just coming out now or recently?
Yeah, it just came out last month from Inner Traditions, the publisher. And I have a second book, actually, that also came out in September, which is called Breaking Through the Materialistic Deception. It's a book, there's a cover of it.
Oh, cool. Is that also from Inner Traditions?
No, that's not. But it's about, it's an overview of materialism and how pervasive it is. And the Inner Traditions book, Alchemical Light Work, takes up where the other book leaves off.
Okay.
So they kind of fit together rather well, actually.
Huh.
So what's your definition of alchemy and how it fits into the present-day world?
Well, there are different kinds of alchemy traditionally. One is, working with plants and making tinctures, and I've done some of that. Then there's working with metals and transforming metals, and there's also spiritual alchemy. And that's what I've been working with a practitioner of for many years. And so we actually did a book earlier together, and we're doing another one coming up. And that's a book about alchemical practice, how spiritual alchemy, the third kind, is really about how to understand, first of all, and transform our lives. It gives us a map for moving from being caught to being free. And so alchemy is a practice of transmutation or transformation, moving from the stage of darkness through light to illumination. So that's essentially what alchemy is.
I have a question. Early in your book, you mentioned the dark. And the way you describe it, I mean, astrologically, that's Pluto. You know, it's Pluto entering Aquarius for the first time in 250 years. And Pluto's nature is first you destroy everything and then you build from the ashes. So I found that interesting.
Well, it is interesting. And there is an astrological dimension to alchemy, which you see a little bit in this book.
Uh-huh.
We don't go into, in this book, I didn't go into all of the elements, astrological elements, mm-hmm. which we will do in the next book, which will be a jointly authored book on going much deeper into spiritual practice, the practice of alchemy. But you're absolutely right. And I mean,
you mentioned Mars, which I thought was perfect.
That's true. We are in a transitional period, and a lot of what the book is about, and one of the reasons I wrote it, is mm-hmm. not only about our own time, although it is about that, but also looking forward, how do you create a culture that is more balanced and more profound than what we experience typically in the modern world? And that, as you say, there's a stage of breaking down mm-hmm. and there's a stage of building up, and we're in the breaking down stage right now.
How long does that usually last? Come on, give us a time frame.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah. So alchemy is also has a link to returning to the natural world, I believe. And we're living in a very high-tech digital world, which is far from the natural world, actually. And how do we recover that? And why is that important?
Well, you're absolutely right. In both books, I discuss the fundamental nature of the world that we find ourselves in, the society we find ourselves in, which is very dualistic. Everything in a materialistic society is objectified and separate. We're separate from it. And that's an illusion, really, because it's good for production, things like factory production, where you reduce things to a basic element, set of elements, and you fashion something out of it. For that kind of thing, it works very well. But there's a much more profound way of understanding nature and nature's processes, and that alchemy opens a door into. And so that's what the book is about, is understanding nature and ourselves in a much deeper way.
Yeah. And you also write quite a bit about the issues of materialism, and then now you have that other book too. How do you convince people to give up materialism when it's, for a lot of people, it's really just a struggle to meet ends, you know, in the everyday life?
Well, absolutely. But I should be clear, when I'm using the term materialism, what I'm referring to is the belief system that insists that everything is only material, that okay. only the material world exists, and we are separate beings. Living separated from nature, and of course progressing and moving ever better into an ever better technological paradise of surveillance. And so we live in a very materialistic world, in the sense of not recognizing that there are more profound dimensions to the world around us. And so that's what alchemical lightwork is in part about, is opening the door to seeing that there's actually a much deeper way of understanding ourselves and the natural world. And there are actually three realms that I discuss in the book. One is of course the human. Another is nature, the natural, and the third is spiritual. And the combination, the balance and interconnection of those three is what produces a culture. And we actually, in the modern world, we have achieved great material power, technological power. Here we are talking through these devices. It's amazing, really. And I appreciate it. I'm not opposed to it. But what I'm saying is that it is possible to develop a deeper way of understanding that combines nature, the human, and the spirit together. And that's what alchemy is about.
Arthur, is that why you live in the woods? I mean, just to remind yourself of the nature part of this?
Well, I grew up on a family farm and have always had a connection to the natural world, to gardening, farming, to the natural cycles. But what I wasn't taught when I was growing up, and I didn't realize until later, was that there's a long tradition in Europe and actually in some aspects of American history of recognizing that there are elements of nature that are not only physical, they're not only materialistic. And so that's a journey. And that's a journey to come to understand nature in a different way. And to give you an example, in Western Europe, it was very common to understand that when you lived in a house, you actually had a hearth spirit. There was a spirit of the house. And this was always understood to be where the fire is, where the hearth is. And the spirit is something that you recognize, or that there's a spirit of the land. There are different spirits of trees. This is there in Greek mythology. It's there in Northern European traditions, folk traditions. And so being in nature is more than simply a matter of physically being in nature. Mm-hmm. And that's a journey.
Well, okay, you said that you've delved into the nature part of this in terms of gardening and tinctures. Like, what can you explain that? I mean, what kind of tinctures are you creating?
Well,
did you?
I've done different practices working with plants, for example, and this is not part of the book. The book is about the practice of spiritual alchemy, which is a transformative alchemy where we find ourselves in a dark place, in a place that traditionally is understood in Latin as negredo, which is the black. We move through white, we have illumination, and then red is the final stage, the rubedo. And so this is a very natural process. And working with plants is the same. With plants, what you're doing, it varies, but essentially you can intensify the strength of a plant by using, for example, alcohol. So you can make tincture without kind of high-proof alcohol. That's one way of creating a tincture. There's different aspects to that. And actually, I'm not alone in doing this. Actually, a friend of mine, Christopher McIntosh, and I did a conversation on Hyros Institute with a Czech alchemist who lives not too far from Prague. And during the conversation, he lifted up, he just nonchalantly lifted up and it held up a tincture bottle of a tincture that he had made quite recently. So it's not at all unusual, you know, to do that. And it was part of the folk tradition in European tradition going back many, many millennia.
Well, is alchemy prevalent in Czechoslovakia?
Yeah.
It is.
Okay. Yeah. I wouldn't say prevalent, but it exists there.
Uh-huh.
This young alchemist is a exemplar of that.
So your book at the center of your book is really the ancient document called the Emerald Tablet. Can you talk a bit about that and how you chose that as the heart of your book?
Yeah, that's an ancient text which goes back several thousand years, which is very enigmatic, and it is the manifestation, it tells us, of Hermes, the great Hermes, thrice great Hermes. And remember, I mentioned the three worlds, three realms, and Hermes is called the thrice great Hermes, and Hermes Trismegistus. And he tells us in this that there are these principles, basic principles to the way nature works and how we also can work with nature. And so each of the aphorisms that
I
he
think
has.
Hermes just walked in our door. Our dog's barking at it. I'm going to go.
Okay. Go ahead, Trish.
Yeah.
Let me.
Nigel. Okay. I think it's Hermes.
Okay. I think
it was Hermes.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you should be able to edit this out without any problem.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, John's good at that.
Yeah. Well, so the Emerald Tablet is set up with short sayings that each saying is a different element of the process of spiritual transformation.
Okay. So are you certain of the age of it? Is there some question about whether that might have been just like from the 18th century or the 19th century?
Oh, no, there's evidence of it, different versions of it going back into Arabic. And okay. So it's existed. Now, there are other texts that are much more modern. This one is referred to, throughout history, and it's referred through to in classical alchemical texts during the Great Renaissance, in the early modern period around the Renaissance and after. Mm-hmm. There was a flowering of alchemy in Western Europe, and it recurs. I also draw on a classical set of illustrations called the Rose Garden of the Philosophers, or Rosarium Philosophorum, which is a sequence of images that also show a process, and it's a spiritual process between a couple. Mm-hmm. And so the book is organized not only around the Emerald Tablet, so each chapter has an epigraph of the Emerald Tablet, from the Emerald Tablet, but it also has these color illustrations that have never been published before.
Oh, those are at the beginning of your book.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Transformation of a
really
couple.
Nice.
Yeah.
They came from Scotland, right?
Yeah, they did. That library was kind enough to allow them to be reproduced. But there are multiple versions, a very famous collection, very well known. But what its meaning is not as widely disseminated. And so I included it in the book. So the book, in addition to being about the three realms that I talked about, is also about individuals, couples, and communities. And all three of those aspects are in this book on alchemy, which, as far as I know, has not been done before. I don't know anyone that's applied alchemy in particular to those three areas.
Now, you mentioned alchemical communities. Do any exist?
Well, the way alchemy works is it's a map. It gives you a map for how transformation happens, and the actual practices depend. There have been, I give an example of an alchemical community at the end of the book, a couple examples, but one in particular is a historical example from 17th century, where it's the account of a young man who was in an alchemical community following this tradition. Oh. So that is in there. But I also have a short story, which is a futuristic manifestation of this. So there are historical examples, but there also is a different way of understanding it, which is how does community transform and emerge into a new cultural unity? And that is really a question that the book points toward an answer to. So
I mean, do any exist now in this century in the United States?
Well, It depends, because what I'm saying is that it depends how you think about it, because of course there are some groups of different practitioners, but alchemy as a way of understanding how transformation happens can happen in any community because it's a natural process. So this is the process that happens in a community. It doesn't require the a specific practice coming back to this period, although that is happening. There are people doing it. However, it's also a map. So anyone who's living in a community, and that community has a shared spiritual center, is engaged in this already. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's a map to that transformation. So it's both of those things are true. And so,
I'm sorry, go ahead. Rob, could Casadega be a alchemical community?
I think it's kind of backwards in some ways. It's a spiritualist community, with, you know, basically, from the early part of the 20th century.
Yeah, but all the people who practice there are not backwards.
It's true. So, Arthur, I was wondering, the black to the white, can that be accomplished without entering a dystopian society, which, is being, it'd be basically wiped out of the way we live now?
Well, the transformation that I'm talking about in the book fundamentally is individual. First. And so it's dealing with our shadow side, dealing with the things we inherit, the things we've created for ourselves, the difficulties, and working through that. And so that's the beginning. But it's also a collective thing. There's a collective element to that. We inherit not only our own individual things, but we're also, if let's say I'm living in New York City, I'm inheriting New York City. I'm inheriting I'm experiencing not only my own personal life, but the entirety of the kind of mental hive, that energy of New York City. And so how do we move toward a more balanced way of life wherever we are and whatever our situation? And so the book is about that in part. And that's, first of all, an individual journey, but it also can be a shared journey with a couple. And it ultimately can also be a community journey, could be only a handful of people, but still, that's a community, the beginning, the nucleus, you could say. And so part of what I think your question is about is, what kind of time are we living in? And we're living in a period of enormous distraction, and enormous distraction of technology, machinery, social media. It's harder and harder to know even what to believe because all of these different things get reflected back to us and processed. You see an image, you don't know if it was created by an AI system or what it was. Is it real? Is the news real? And so that kind of uncertainty is intensifying. So how do we return to and ground ourselves in nature and in a deeper way of being? And alchemy is the path for doing that, because it gives you the map. It gives you the overview of how you do it. So even if you're living in the heart of New York City, you can certainly go to be in nature. There are places that are natural within even highly intense urban environments. There are natural places anywhere. And the processes that are in the book are natural processes, which mean that they're open to any of us. So that would be my short answer.
Can you send your book to some politicians who don't know this? we would immediately be in a better place.
What do you think life will be like in 2100?
Well, it's a good question. I think What's happening right now is a kind of bifurcation, a kind of there's a part of our society that's hell-bent on separating itself from nature and from human, you know, human existence, and also from a spiritual realm. And that is what you see with AI, for example, with the creation I mentioned in the book, the so-called metaverse, mm-hmm. that, you know, is a it's a perversion of a name, really, because meta means transcendent. And a metaverse, in the sense that Facebook is attempting to create it, is apparently is virtual. It's not transcendent. It's, I call it an infraverse, meaning below. It's a belowverse. It's a false nature. So you move into this virtual realm. There's only illusion. There's no real nature. You see, you're talking with a human, but it's not really a human. It's fundamentally separated from the grounding of who we are and can be in the world. So that's the one direction. The other direction is back toward a deeper grounding in the spiritual and natural worlds and in the human world, and really flourishing and understanding what it means to flourish. So if you follow these two out, then in 2100, to answer your question, Rob, I think it's very likely that you'll have ultimately a crash of this kind of system. I think the system that we're developing is very fragile, and it's very energy intensive. And therefore, it will at some point crack up. And on the other side of that, what is natural and spiritual and profound will return.
Yeah, will it happen before 2100? That's my. We won't be alive in 2100. So,
well, it can happen tomorrow for us. Yeah. Part of the point of the book is for us, it can happen right now,
anytime.
So, yeah. Arthur, are you familiar with a book from the early 1990s called Mass Dreams for the Future by Chet Snow and Helen Wambaugh? Is that familiar?
No, I'm not familiar with that.
Okay. So they're psychologists or psychiatrists, and they hypnotized several thousand people over several years, and they took them to future lives. And then they wrote this book that analyzes all of those future lives and put them into three categories of what people saw. And some of them came up with lives that were in 2100 to 2200, and others came up with lives much further up, 2200 to 2400. And they were broken down into three different futures. One was an ultra-tech society that exists underground, so a lot of people picked up on that. Another one was a back-to-future nature, kind of a archaic future, in a sense. And the third one was people who saw communities living in space on, like, space stations. So it's kind of parallels what you're saying, although there's three here with the addition of the space alternative, but it's interesting that, you know, that they were able to group them like this, and that so many people, nobody was seeing a future that's just like us we're having now.
Well, yeah, it's I saw a conversation with this gentleman whose name I can't recall, who was discussing very much what you're talking about, and he was a collator of people who had visions of the future, and thousands and thousands of people whose visions he had transcribed, and it was along the lines you're talking about. What he was trying to do was sift it down until it was very, you know, very, he could center on a particular interpretation, one alone. But it,
that'd be tough.
You know, if you think about the world that we're living in right now, it's entirely possible for people to be living in very different worlds, even though they're in this the same one, in the sense that the reality of somebody who primarily plays video games and is vested in a metaverse, an infraverse, is going to be a totally different life experience than somebody who is living in the wilderness, let's say. You can have a completely different life experience right today. And I think that is very probable that that will be the case in the future as well. So all three of these might very well exist.
Yeah. A lot of the people who we interview tend to be of the mystical type of personality. And they often say about the future is that things will develop where this dualism, this conflict we have in the world now will move beyond, and we'll be living like those people that are on the other side will kind of vanish from our lives. They'll live on like a separate realities in a sense.
It's share the same earth.
Yeah, it's like earth and earth one. I think we already have that, but we're still in conflict though.
Earth one and earth two.
Yeah, right. Do you see anything like that possibly happening? I mean, that's really on the mystical side.
Well, what I've done with the Alchemical Lightwork book is provide this overall map of, you know, individual transformation that comes out of this tradition that most people are not familiar with. And it points toward, and I've applied it in the book to, a future that for those who engage in it, and what I suggest in the book, actually, there's a short story at the end that I put in. I didn't know whether they were going to keep it or not, really, when I put it in there, and they did.
Is it your short story?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
I got to read this. I haven't finished the book, so.
Yeah. And the short story is very much along the lines of what we're talking about, which is, there's a young man, and he's living in this city, fairly technological, and he goes out into the countries. And as he goes out, he discovers this area where there's initially he sees the outskirts of a community, and he meets this young woman, and she shows him into the community. And he realizes that these people exist in a completely parallel world that he had no idea existed. And they simply chose to buy property, live in the same area, which, you know, it's not a far-fetched idea. It's exactly what the Amish do. Uh-huh. We have Amish right here, right in the area. Mennonites do it, these different Christian groups. It's not a far-fetched idea. It's entirely possible to create a parallel society, and that's effectively what he suddenly discovers is there, and he had no idea. It was right outside town. It was, you know, he just lived in this bubble world, you know?
Right. Yeah, that's interesting.
Well, I'm glad they published that. That's good. That kind of sums up your book in a sense.
Yeah, it was the beginning of, it just came. It just came, and so I had it in there, and I thought if down the road it turns into a novel, well, then we can.
You ought to do that. That would be fascinating to explore, you know.
Yeah, an alternative. It's a very, in a way, it's a very simple, it's the simplest of models, the simplest of ways, which is, you have people of like mind who settled in the same area. It's the American story, really.
Yeah.
Right?
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So one of the things that struck me in your book is that you said we stand at the threshold of a new culture, seated in darkness but destined for illumination. And there's a lot in the book that's about dark and light. And how do you see this this change taking place from the dark to the light? And I mean, we've been talking about this, but the light exists now, doesn't it? But in only small areas or whatever that. But you see it then exploding into something more.
Well, what I'm discussing in the book is really, as I mentioned before, individuals, couples, and small communities. And so the book is not envisioning a grand transformation of society, but rather a decentralized emergence, a decentralized flourishing. So what happens here in rural Michigan is different than what happens in the mountains of New Mexico. Okay. Those are fundamentally different landscapes, and the people who settle there, who live there, are different. And so when you have a culture emerge, you see this, for example, in Japan. Japanese culture emerges out of this connection between the Japanese people, the spirits, kami, and nature. And this forms culture. And so culture can happen, as it does in Japan, wherever you have this connection. And so the vision in the book is not toward a vast transformation, but rather a flowering that's localized. And the localizing is really important, actually, because that's how the connections between these things, between these realms, can take place.
That's also how something bigger begins.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's true. But bigger meaning, cultures grow, but they have their natural sphere. Mm-hmm. So culture emerges in a place with a particular people and a particular spiritual set of connections. And those things are mysterious. They happen alchemically. And so the vision in the book is actually very different than, a New Age vision, where the idea is that transformation happens outside us. It happens from a top-down model and so on. This is a way of understanding that is very much aligned with the American spirit, which is settling across this vast terrain, and each place has its own unique characteristics, and we recognize that and we appreciate it.
Well, what do you do in a place like Florida that's all tourists? I mean, all these people bring different cultures and beliefs and, expectations.
Yeah, that's a different story. But there are places in Florida. I was in Florida several years ago, took a trip down, driving through Florida, and from the top to the bottom. And there are wild areas in the middle of Florida.
That's true.
There are areas in the Everglades and elsewhere where it's very different. And then there's what the Florida folks refer to as old Florida, which also exists, right? So it's not like there's a uniform. It's possible for the kind of transformation we're talking about to happen anywhere. It's not limited to any particular place. Yeah. And yeah, I thought it was a little crowded down there, but.
and just real quick, disembodied voice of John, real quick. That's something I have had to deal with in my day job this past year. This whole, just one size fits all. No, If you tell me one size fits all, that's a red flag immediately, because it is, you know, depending on what project you're working on or what
you do, John.
Well, I don't know that I need to go into that.
Oh, okay.
but and yeah, it's just, yeah, this whole idea that one size fits all doesn't work. And yeah, it's, we have to come to this as individuals or communities or whatever, everything that, I think has been talked about today, that is, or tonight, that's exactly the point is, it's not, it has to come from the ground up, not from the top down.
Mm-hmm. Arthur, also, you mentioned the importance of religion. And yet, right now, religion is used as a political tool, political weapon.
Well, there are different aspects of that. But in the book, Alchemical Lightwork, and in the other books that I've done with this friend of mine, actually, we're drawing on a tradition which is current of Christianity. It's a Christian form of spiritual alchemy that most people would have never heard of, and that is completely separate from what you could call confessional. It's not in opposition. It's not opposed to it, but mm-hmm. confessional traditions within Christianity, which are what most people know. What we're talking about here is a transformative tradition of invocation. And so there are forms of religion that are focused on transformation. So an example of that is in Eastern Orthodoxy or Greek Orthodoxy, you have what's called the hesychastic tradition, which is invoking the light of Jesus. And that tradition is part of what my friend is connected to. And so he draws on that. But the Hermetic tradition draws on Hermes. We need some kind of power beyond ourselves in order to transform. And the Emerald Tablet is attributed to Hermes, and the idea is Hermes is the revealer. In Christianity, it's Christ, and it's invoking the light of Christ. You also have alchemy, by the way, in Buddhism and in Hinduism and alchemical practices, and there's a lot of parallels, actually. It's quite surprising, the crossover between these different alchemical traditions. So there's a Christian alchemy, there's a Buddhist alchemy, and a Hindu alchemy, and a Hermetic alchemy, going back to Greek and ancient Rome. So those all are possible, but the map of alchemy applies to all of them. Uh-huh. They all are involved. It helps describe this path toward flourishing and deeper meaning to life. And that's really what alchemical light work is about.
Hmm. How about Judaism? Does it have any kind of alchemical?
Judaism has the Kabbalistic tradition.
Uh-huh.
And the origins of which are a little bit obscure to me. I'm not a Kabbalist, a scholar of Kabbalah. Also, Islam. So you have Islamic alchemy. Those do, as I understand it, exist, but I'm not that familiar with examples of Jewish alchemy myself. I do have some sources that I think have referred to that, but alchemy, as I have been taught it and that I understand it, is primarily actually a European phenomenon that flowered in the 17th, 18th century, especially.
Isaac Newton was an alchemist, I believe.
He was. That's absolutely true. Yeah. Alchemy was quite widespread, and it's a way of understanding nature which is not in conflict with science, actually. It's including elements that science doesn't, materialistic science doesn't recognize. Quantum physics might be slightly different. although in my experience, not dramatically. There's a lot of materialists in quantum physics, it appears.
Well, I think that Carl Jung was a type of alchemist, at least in terms of psychology and what he opened up for the whole field.
He was absolutely deeply aware of the things that I write about in the book, and he referred to them, wrote about them, drew on them for his work. No question, he was, you could say, a psychological alchemist.
Right.
Yeah.
I think Nikola Tesla was a type of alchemist as well.
What type, though? A scientific alchemist? I mean...
Well, he worked with these unusual machines with creating a wireless reality. And I think that, you know, his life was one that was, explored a type of alchemy that, you know, wouldn't be the, what we would normally consider as alchemy, but I think
that gave us the internet, Rob.
yeah. But I wanted to ask you, Arthur, do you think, are you aware of there being any kind of dark alchemy, people who use alchemy for power and control?
No.
Okay. All right. I'm writing about that. I'm actually writing a novel that deals with alchemy and with the dark and the light.
I see. Yeah, yeah. It's just a fascinating area, and there's so many different aspects to it. And but no, I'm not familiar with that. Alchemy as a in the popular. Presentation of it is often depicted as somebody looking for gold or trying to create gold and get rich, or somebody who is looking for the philosopher's stone, never quite clear what that is. But the process of alchemy itself is a process of flowering and also of perfecting. The idea of alchemy is that originally, we were in a pure world and are fundamentally pure, and we can restore that. It can be restored, not through us individually, through our own effort, but it is possible to restore an original balance. And that underlying idea is there in alchemy, but it applies to nature, and it applies to us as individuals. It applies to communities potentially, and so that's really what I'm focusing on. And there's no dark side to that. In other words, the only dark side is dealing with our shadow, dealing with our dark aspects, and illuminating those and transforming those. And so, by its very nature, it is not an alchemical path if it doesn't go in that direction.
Yeah. Jung again, Jung in the shadow. He talked a lot about the shadow.
He did.
Yeah.
But the alchemist, the dark alchemist, would be one who pursues the gold, the riches, the creation through the material world. I mean, maybe you wouldn't even consider that an alchemist, but he'd be using the aspects of alchemy to create such a...
Well, in some sense, the modern technology is that. It's a transformative technology used for selfish means. That's basically what we have. They knew when Facebook was created, or when Twitter, or the different, you know, these different social media forms were created, they knew it was addictive. And they engineered it for addiction. It's not alchemy, because alchemy only goes in one direction, which is toward greater flourishing, harmony, balance. But this is a kind of, you could say,
perversion.
kind of reverse alchemy, going in the opposite direction. And that's effectively what's happened, actually. Uh-huh. And what's interesting about it is that it's very hard for us to resist it, right? It's addictive because it attracts us to it, and it encourages a lot of, you know, angry emotions. So people are filled with rage and much more because it encourages that, and it encourages, you know, outrage. And I asked students, I was giving a meditation workshop to students, and there were a couple hundred of them. And you know, I said, the statistics show that you guys are pretty unhappy. You know, is that true? And why would that be if it's true? And so we started talking, and they said, it's, to be frank about it, it's social media that it's caused a lot of our unhappiness. Mm-hmm. They see their friends being presenting themselves as if they're, you know, wealthy and happy and everything is great, and then they feel jealous, and it generates all these negative emotions. That's what the students told me.
Wow.
And I think that's absolutely true. So that is a form of kind of reverse, you could call it reverse alchemy. It's alchemy going in the wrong direction.
Well, but what about Google, which for the most part is not a huge social component, but we're dumping a lot of ourselves into just data collection as far as, you know, what am I searching? You know, they're, you know, it, we are contributing to the algorithm in that, in within the Google system, we're giving ourselves to that, because anytime we search for something, they're collecting that data. And so then we're going to get an ad or whatever.
He used Brave.
Well, fair enough. But most people don't realize that. Yeah. It is a business model. It is, and kind of is some kind of alchemy, because they're collecting your thoughts and then monetizing that somehow.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but you know what, John? What did we do before Google? You went off to the library to look for a book.
You know what? But nobody was mining what books we checked out.
Well,
or read.
That's a good point.
Yeah, I see your point. Yeah. Now, Arthur, how did you get on this journey?
Well, I started many years ago exploring. Really, my work is exploring areas that are not very much covered, that it's new terrain. I know it had to exist. So I had read about Sufism, for example, in Islam, you know, and Sufism sounded pretty interesting. And then I realized that there actually was an equivalent to that. There was something like that in Western European Christian tradition. But nobody had written about it, so I started writing about it.
Okay.
And I gave a talk in Minneapolis and at a bookstore. I gave a couple talks there. And this guy comes up to me afterwards, and he says, you know, you and I should talk. And he had in his hand this manuscript. It was an alchemical manuscript. And we became friends over many decades, actually. And so he's the one who taught me what is in alchemical light work. And I owe quite a bit to him. And I'm doing a book with him coming up. I did one earlier with him called Conversations in Apocalyptic Times. And
title.
Yeah, that we did that one several years ago. We've got one coming up, which is a very deep dive into how you do alchemical practice, how alchemy works, what the different aspects are. So it's coming probably in 2026. We're about 3/4 done, maybe 90% done. So that's how I got into this. It was through him, but also my own incorrigible spirit of exploration. Yeah. And on Hyros Institute, that's what we also do. It's we call it co-exploration. And I have a course on Hyros Institute which is complementary to this book. It's a course called Gathering Light, the Alchemical Lightwork course. And that's nothing comes from that to me. It goes to the nonprofit Hyros. So people are welcome to come check that out. And that's how you become a co-explorer, because that that gives background and it gives practices and gives people a understanding of alchemical practice.
What sign are you? I mean, what month were you born in?
I was born in May. But it depends what calendar, because the Vedic calendar actually
different.
I would be Aries, and because it's different. It is different. And in the Western, it'd be Taurus. Astrology is an interesting.
Area. Vedic is confusing to me because I'm so versed in Western astrology that when I read something about Vedic, my brain kind of explodes. I think, wait a minute, I'm not that sign.
Yeah, that's right. There's a whole series of things that are tied in with that in terms of the procession, the zodiacal procession and various things. But what I've found is that the different systems each provide their own, provide insights in different ways.
Right.
They have a different, you know, it's really, people don't realize, but it's really it's mathematical. It's all mathematical. Ultimately, it's three-dimensional mathematics. That's what astrology is about.
That's true.
Mathematical patterns. So, yeah.
Arthur, that's why you need software.
Arthur, did you find that your fellow academic folks were skeptical about alchemy when you brought the subject up?
Well, I've been teaching a course for more than 20 years, more than 25 years on magic and mysticism. And when I first taught it, you know, it was the first course, as far as I know, in the country that was on magic and mysticism, and in a public university. It's historically organized. It's pretty hard to argue with the course because it's introducing things that are very real, and you can prove it. And it has a textbook which is historically organized. So, no, I haven't really encountered that. I have two kinds of books. I have books that are hardcore academic. So my last academic book, American Gnosis, had about a thousand footnotes or endnotes. This one, Alchemical Lightwork, doesn't have any. And
for the popular mind.
Yeah, well, it doesn't require them. It does have some references here and there, but suggested reading. But it's an introduction to alchemy from a practical level. And I'm not, presenting it as an academic book. It's a book for what are the benefits of alchemy? How do we understand it? What is its meaning for us? And what can we draw from it that's useful for the future? Because we need a better blueprint than what we got right now.
That's for sure.
So were the editors at Destiny Books okay with you not using any footnoting?
Yeah, they were fine with that.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a good publisher. They publish great books.
Right.
Yeah, they do.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back a bit to the Emerald Tablet. There's something in there that says, I'm wondering, what does it mean to go from Earth to Heaven and back again?
There's different ways to understand that. And one way is there's this saying that you're probably familiar with, as above, so below.
Right. Yeah.
This reciprocity between the invisible and the visible. And what I'm talking about in the materialistic deception book, it's entitled Breaking Through the Materialistic Deception, because we deceive ourselves into believing that there's only the physical world, the material world. And there is nothing else. And I've had people say that directly to me, you know, just there's nothing else, you know, that's what they believe. And when you die, it's just like you turn off a TV, you know, that's their belief. And, you know, that's a belief system, but that is not the traditional way of understanding that you see in alchemy, which is that there is a reciprocity between the spiritual and the natural. Mm-hmm. And so one of the reasons we have so much disruption in weather patterns and in different ways in nature, so for example, droughts, very extreme droughts, well, it's quite possible, isn't it, that there's a reciprocity between these realms, but we've separated it, we've severed it, so that there isn't the spiritual connection to nature. So then the patterns, the rhythms get thrown off. And how do we begin to restore that? And that's part of what alchemical practice is about.
Then you should teach a meteorology course that deals with alchemy. And so get things back on track again.
Well, the traditional understanding is that nature includes spirits, that there are spirits. Mm-hmm. This is through European, Northern European, Southern European tradition, across Central Europe today. I was in Switzerland, actually, in a research library, and I met this young Swiss military guy in the military, and he was doing research. We started talking, and it turns out his grandparents had taught him about the spirits in nature, that there was this living nature tradition in his family. What does that mean? Well, what it means is that if we think of nature as only materialistic, mm-hmm. only materialistic, we're ignoring a deeper dimension of it. And so in ancient tradition, that was recognized. And when we recognize it as human beings, we recognize there's a spiritual dimension. And our role is to balance things through maybe making offering of some kind of substance or through different ways that we act in deference to the natural world, not driving a bulldozer through the middle of it, maybe. Then the natural world is much more attuned to its natural rhythms. The rhythms are not thrown off. We assume, because we're so separated from our ancient understanding of the world and from nature itself, we assume that we can live in our total bubble, completely separate from everything, and whatever we do, it's fine. Well, what if that has consequences in nature? What if nature gets thrown off by that? I think that's exactly what we're seeing.
Yeah.
And so we need a more balanced and grounded way. And there are folk traditions that suggest that how to do that.
Don't tick off the spirits. That's the moral of the story. Yeah.
Well, that's a American Indian way of understanding it as well. Right. Yeah. I've heard that directly from elders. Hmm.
So we know some people who are involved in light work in a different way, and it's called light language. It's kind of like speaking in tongues. Are you familiar with light language?
Not at all. Okay. No.
We'll send you some videos.
Okay.
See if you can decipher it.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds interesting.
They have conventions where everybody speaks in light language, and nobody knows what anybody else is saying, basically. But it's like
supposedly it was the original language.
It's related
before the Tower of Babel.
Yeah, and it's related to it's related to mediumship.
Yeah,
yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, there are some very interesting things that people have come up with, and I cannot say I'm familiar with all of them. Yeah.
Okay. You'll enjoy this light language stuff, but if you decipher it, let us know what it means.
Okay, well, it sounds like speaking in tongues in Christianity.
Yeah, actually. It does. It's very similar.
There is a parallel there. Well, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, this has been great, Arthur.
Mystical
thank you.
Underground. We appreciate you joining us for this
hour. Do you ever teach by Zoom?
I do sometimes, and I have, there are a couple of courses on Hyros Institute, which is just hyros.institute,
okay.
You know, that people are welcome to check out. And, you know, I have done some Zoom courses, and we may do more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, Hyros is spelled H-I-E-R-O-S.
That's right.
And tell people where they can find your website and that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, my books are on arthurversluis.com, but hyros.institute is probably the best, okay, because that has some videos and courses and different things, different resources for people.
Okay.
So that's a good meeting place, too. And, you know, of course, the books can be found, Inner Traditions books can be found, like Alchemical Lightwork, at Simon & Schuster. They have their own distribution system. And then, of course, Amazon, if you're, you know, if you're an Amazon user, then, of course, they're on there, and various other places. So you're welcome. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, I appreciate
it. I'm sending you a light language video.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we'll let you know when this is coming on, too.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll send you a link.
Okay. Sounds good. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Bye now.
Bye.
Thanks for joining The Mystical Underground. Visit www.themysticalunderground.com for the latest blog post and book info. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or your favorite podcast app. Listen to the podcast at podcast.themysticalunderground.com. Follow Trish and Rob on Instagram at Trish and Rob McGregor. Follow us on Twitter at The Mystic Cast. Send email to podcast@themysticalunderground.com. And until next week, thank you for listening, and stay mystical.